So please turn to Genesis chapter 37, reading verses 1 through 11. And Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought an evil report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his sons, because he was the son of old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peace to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream that I dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brother said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us?" And so they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." And when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come and bow ourselves to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. It's a common adage. It goes back, at least so it is believed, to Aristotle. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. The whole story has properties that its parts don't have. The surpassing properties accrue from the interaction between the parts, something of which we elucidated this morning already. And this passage and its message very much follow suit. So you can consider this to be a deepening of what we have learned and considered this morning. Consider a book. A book has many chapters, but its timeless story transcends the sum of these chapters. Because in the story that is being told through the chapters, there is also a timeless message, an overarching message that becomes applicable far beyond the time in which the story is set or plays itself out. Now, Genesis 37 through 50 is the so-called Joseph cycle, or simply the Joseph story. If you want to grasp its significance, you need to step back and look at the big picture. It was God's intention, already revealed to Abram in Genesis 15, to bring Israel under foreign domination. Until, this is what God said to Abram in a vision in Genesis 15, the iniquity of the Amorites, synonym for the Canaanites, should be full and the land of Canaan ripe for possession. So the train of events, a long train of events leading Israel down to Egypt and under foreign domination, is set in motion now, here in the conflict of the 12 sons, of which we see the first installment. The tale is a classic exhibition of providence and sovereignty, making it bigger than the sum of its parts, because it tells you things of God that you would not be able to see or know by looking at the parts. But when you see them interact in the way they do, you discern the hand or the mind of God. The story shows a pattern of hostility all the way through, a pattern of consistent hostility that runs through the Old Testament all the way to Calvary. The rejection of God's chosen deliverers through the envy and hatred of their own kin. It is, as we said this morning, this hostility against God's deliverers among God's very own people is like the key that is stuck on the wrong side of the door, locking you out. You should be shut out. You should remain outside. But God, nevertheless, is able to unlock the door, open the door, and bring you as he brings things together. And what could be more damaging to God's plans than these destructive forces? As the Proverbs say, a brother is born for adversity. The contentions of brothers are like the bars of a castle. And yet, it's a pattern of hostility which is made to play a salient part in the redemption of God's people. It really is a tale of God's sovereignty according to the purpose of him who works out all things after his own counsel or will. All right, now when you consider this introduction to the cycle of Joseph, you see two themes that compete with each other, in the way that some of you siblings compete with each other. As a matter of fact, in the way that these siblings compete with each other. Two themes that compete and strive for supremacy. The one theme is an escalating fraternal hostility, leading to Joseph's total isolation in the family as a 17-year-old. The other theme is a growing foresight, a growing vision like the rising sun of future greatness, the greatness of Joseph. Joseph is destined to rule. But how will his brother's hostility fit into this grand vision? Here is where the sovereignty of God is at work and prevails in a world of hostility, fraternal rivalry, opposition, and a world of human scheming. And by the time he is finished with his plan, every knee will bow before him, and there will be nothing left to prove. Now let's see how the author portrays this escalating fraternal hostility that leads to Joseph's isolation and vulnerability. There is, first of all, a numeric aspect to this growing hostility among the brothers. As you notice, first we are told that he was a boy, the text says, a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. The sons of Bilhah and Zilpah were four, Dan, Gad, Asher, and Naphtali. And so the language that is being used here is language that in other parts of the Hebrew Bible can mean an apprenticeship. The relationship between Joseph and his four older brothers is that of an apprentice. Here, in this particular context, it means more like the father, Jacob, assigned Joseph to be with them and to be a helping hand to these four brothers out there in the field with the cattle. And these four brothers, they are alienated from Joseph because Joseph keeps bringing evil reports to their father. Now, the precise nature of these reports, we're told nothing about them, but Joseph did inform his father. They saw him as an informer, and they were therefore alienated from him. But then if you turn the page to the second step, or the second part of this narrative, it is not only these four that have reason to be unhappy with Joseph. In the next scene, you see how all his brothers now hate him because they have begun to understand that Joseph is his daddy's darling. And he loves them, loves him more than them. And then, of course, he also makes a code to say, yes. And they can't stand it. And they hate him for it. So it's four brothers and then all of the 11. So there's a numeric aspect of this growing hostility. However, the spiraling of hostility is more graphically shown in four steps that are like this. They descend into a dark place of enmity and violence that is looming over Joseph's head. So these four steps are alienation. I commented on this. From alienation to hatred. From hatred to even more intense hatred. And the fourth and final step is jealousy. And like Lemony Snicket's series of unfortunate events, hardship and pain are about to be poured out on this teenager. Think of these four steps, as I said, descending into a dark place where hopelessness and imminent evil are looming in the shadows. Here's the first step, it's alienation. Now, I said a few things about this, but I'd like to elucidate this a little more because I think that it's worthwhile pondering. Verse 2 specifies that Joseph brought an evil or a bad report on Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, to their daddy. Now, I know that some of you are born tattletales. Some of you use this form of speech more than others. And I know that children can master in the craft. I have even seen parents training their children to be tattletales and to tell on other children. I've seen it with my own eyes. In the same way that Fagin, for example, the old scoundrel from Charles Dickens, trains Oliver Twist to pickpocket and to master in other criminal activities in London. Now, the author restrains his hand, and he won't offer any comments. So, it's possible that Joseph was a real tattletale, and he couldn't help but tell on his brothers because he wanted to bring them into trouble. That's possible. But also possible that he reported serious sins of his brothers. And in light of what they are about to do, don't count that out. They were very capable sinners. Maybe he did report very serious sins of his brothers, such as would even endanger the fortunes of the clan of which Jacob was the patriarch. And by telling these sins to his father, he showed that his first loyalty was to the head of the house, to the family, as it should be. And his brothers, as to them, you know that they are about to join the ranks of kidnappers and potential murderers. And Leviticus chapter 5, verse 1 says that there are such sins that are serious enough to warrant reporting. If you do not report such sins, you yourself become part of the pattern of sin. Well, if this is the case, as I said, you couldn't fault Joseph with telling on his brothers. His first obligation was to his father, the leader of the clan. And when you consider how Jacob's family, not the least Jacob himself, used to be known for deceiving and conniving and covering up iniquity, Joseph's behavior can also be seen as a break with an old pattern of duplicity and iniquity. Be that as it may, his four brothers were certainly alienated, at the very least, by his reports to their dad. And I don't think that they cared about his motivation. They didn't. Now, the next step, step number two, is in verses 3 and 4. Joseph was his dad's pet. He was his darling son, and all his brothers hated him for it. Now, this is a family dynamic that is known in just about any family, where children have the feeling that others are favored over them, and God protect the parents from manifesting such a pattern. But Joseph was Jacob's darling son, and his brothers hated him for it. And this detail aggravates the situation. But in particular, that Jacob, his dad, found it necessary to display his favoritism in having a peculiar coat or a robe made for Joseph. This is a coat that he had manufactured by a tailor, a professionally made thing. The word that is used here to describe the quality of this coat is somewhat difficult, and we don't know exactly what it means. It's translated colorful. It can also mean long-sleeved. Speiser, a commentator, even argues that it is a ceremonial robe with ornamentation. So this would be a robe fit for royalty. And this word is used only once in the Old Testament besides this text. It's found in 2 Samuel chapter 13, verse 18, where the daughters of King David are said to wear these kinds of dresses. So those were dresses that were fit for royal seed, something special, something of a higher quality. And so it is something that you might say may even be ostentatious and provocative, fit for royalty. Well, as verse 4 says, it earned Joseph the hatred of his 11 brothers, so much so, now this is something to relish, to picture, that they couldn't speak peace to them. It's in the same way that you have experienced when you had bitterness in a relationship with another person. Every word that you speak and every word that you hear from the other person seems to have double entendre. And the brothers in particular, they were constantly talking rough to Joseph. They couldn't do otherwise, and words, their words were the outlet of their hatred for now. Step number 3 involves even more intense hostility. And now we enter the realm of dreams of this story. That realm that really drives, that's the motor of this scene that we behold tonight. After telling the first dream of these sheaves in the field, the brothers react with a new surge of malevolence and venom towards their brother. We read in verse 8, they hated him even more. But there is more. A second dream that confirms the basic message of the previous one, Joseph will reign over his brothers and the parents as well, is told by Joseph. And now the brothers are downright jealous. You may wonder, okay, but how is this an intensification? I mean, how is this worse than the first dream? How is this reaction now even worse than the reaction in the previous installments? Well, I think it is worse because jealousy is the most powerful, destructive force in this world in which we live. The Proverbs 27 verse 4 say, "Wrath is cruel and anger is raging, but who can stand before jealousy?" Jealousy of the kind that says, "Not only do I want what you have, but I hate you for it," is the most destructive force in this world. And you also have to see that with this second dream, there was something that began to dawn on the brothers. For now, they not only knew that he had a special deal with his daddy going, he was the darling son of his daddy, and he did love him more than the rest of them. They knew that. But now with the second dream as a confirmation, as it were, the first one they could put away and say, "Well, he's just a fool." The second dream is a confirmation that Joseph was not only beloved of his daddy, but that he had a special deal going with God, because they didn't receive any visions or words from God. They didn't have a special relationship with God. In fact, it is quite debatable that these 11 brothers at this point in their lives, they were, like we say, nominal believers. But they didn't really care about their relationship with God. But what they did care about is that they now knew that Joseph had a special relationship with God. And so they were jealous of this. And the rest is history. When jealousy is mentioned here in the text, it's like the final nail in the coffin. For from here, Joseph, the 17-year-old lad, can only dream of a better place to be. Fyodor Dostoevsky's short story entitled "The Dream of a Ridiculous Man" has the main character dreaming of a world of harmony and love, a brotherhood of men, before he witnesses how all goes to waste in an instant. And in one passage of this short story, he offers his own version of the human dilemma. It really is a brief exposition of the first four chapters of Genesis that end in the fratricide, Cain beating his own brother to death because he was jealous of him on account of God accepting the gift of Abel, but not his own. And he writes, "They loved the lie." That refers to the fall in the garden. "They loved the lie and recognized its beauty. It took possession of their hearts and pleased them. And then came sensuality. And sensuality fathered jealousy. And jealousy brought forth cruelty. Soon the first blood was spilled." Where there is jealousy, there will be blood. And when I read of this escalating hostility of the brothers in four steps descending all the way to jealousy, I remember the trial of Jesus Christ. As a matter of fact, I could begin with the very first day of his ministry in his hometown of Nazareth, when in the synagogue on the Sabbath day, he read from Isaiah. And he spoke of the kingdom of God, and he said, "Today this is fulfilled in your eyes. I am the one that you're waiting for." And the people said, "You're Joseph's son." And they wanted to kill him. And then, of course, at Jesus' trial at the end of his ministry, he said to the Sanhedrin, "From now on, the Son of Man will be seated on the right hand of the power of God." They hated him from the start, and they hated him at the end, because of his words and because of his visions and because of his dreams that often came in the form of stories, parables, for example. They were like dreams of the kingdom of God. And these parables introduced Jesus as none less than the king, the ruler, that everyone has to answer to. And they said, We will not have this one reign over us. Away with him. Now look at the whole passage. You can say that, yeah, maybe Joseph and Jacob had a hand in making the brothers angry. That coat, for example, that wasn't necessary. All right? But the dreams, those two dreams, they came from God. And make no mistake about it, God knew that Joseph had to tell them to his brothers, in the same way that God knew that Jesus had to tell his own, and his own received him not. God knew what the brothers were about to do, and it is as if God accelerates the fermenting wrath and turns it into jealousy until there is no remedy. Now, God would never approve what the brothers are about to do in selling their brother. In fact, at first they just want to kill him. But he tips the balance with these two dreams because they come in a context where God knows what's already going on. It's already in the making. And he tips the balance to violence against Joseph. That is something to behold. But here is a second theme that competes with this first theme, and it points in the opposite direction, a growing foresight of greatness. And this is God's final word in this tale. And the surprising dynamic built into this text is that each of the four steps that I've shown you so far that descend into a dark place and eventually lead to violence, physical violence, they are also pointing upwards as they gradually throw into relief Joseph's destiny to rule. Let me run them by you quickly. First, as I indicated, Joseph had a superior moral compass to his brothers. Yeah, he may have been perceived by them as a tattletale, but as I tried to explain to you, there may have been good reasons for him to tell on his brothers because there was more at stake than just getting them into trouble. It could have gotten the clan into trouble as well. And if the sins were serious enough, I think that he did the right thing. Be that as it may, I think it is clear that he was more righteous than his brothers, and he was loyal to his daddy. Second, verse 3 says that his daddy loved him. And here the ESV says, because he was the son of his old age. The ESV makes it sound as though he was Jacob's baby, and he was. However, the author casts the statement in an ambiguous fashion. The text says that his dad loved him because he was a son of old age. Not a son of his daddy's old age, but he was a son of old age. And elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible, this expression without the personal pronoun his means that you are wise beyond your years. So this can mean that Jacob saw in his son wisdom beyond his years, wisdom that he didn't see in the 11. God, and I think that this is fair to conclude, God had laid his hand on this boy, and he was showing qualities and promise that his brothers didn't possess. But Jacob saw it. There was something special about this boy, and that Joseph was more than a darling that walked, but walked with God is confirmed, eventually confirmed, isn't it? In those two dreams. Dreams that God gave him. Dreams that say he had a special relationship with God, a relationship that his brothers didn't have. God was saying that I'm going to do great things through you. And later in life, of course, he will be known as a sage. Joseph himself will call himself a diviner, saying that I'm able to know and to interpret dreams. And so God was at work in him already at this age. He was destined for greatness. And then, of course, there are the two dreams themselves. Both say the same thing, that Joseph is destined to rule. But the second also expands or develops the first one by its use of these astronomical images. The dreams move from the earth or the field with the sheaves to the sky, to the heavens, sun, moon, and stars, so that Joseph's predicted reign gains almost cosmic significance and proportions. You may think of how the universal reign of Messiah is depicted in Psalm 72, and also linked with the heavenly luminaries and with creation itself. In any case, the four installments of the text deliver a growing foresight, a vision of future greatness. Joseph is destined to rule, and God wanted him to know. Not to speak of his brothers, they also needed to hear it, because they're part of the story. But what I want you to see in particular is that the dreams that Joseph dreams, big dreams, dreams of God, they were meant to be remembered. And they were meant to sustain him in what was coming, in what was ahead of him. And there were no good things in the next few years for Joseph. Now, for now, the story is unfinished. But the two competing themes, they will be one in the end. Soon Joseph will find himself in chains in a foreign land among strangers, hearing a strange language, and in prison, wrongfully accused. How did Joseph survive all that? I mean, how did his faith survive all that? He dreamed big dreams, God's dreams, and never stopped remembering them, never stopped dreaming them, especially in the darkest hours of life. He remembered, but this is what God said. And God has given you dreams, and dreams of a throne and of a peace that you've never known, dreams of his kingdom, so that you may live by them and that you may not lose heart, but remember the dreams that God has given us. I am speaking of his promises. And sometimes you simply have to look the devil and the world straight in the face and say, you can throw at me whatever you want. I will never give up. I will never give up. Say it. Say it to yourself. It honors God because it's an expression of true faith and hope in God's promise, and strengthens you. For you can do all things through Christ who strengthens you. The just man falls seven times and rises again, but the wicked is snared in the time of evil. When you live by God's dreams, God's promises, Jesus Christ takes the lead in your life. For the pattern of Joseph and of all of God's people follows him who suffered and entered into his glory, as we learned this morning, whose name is far above any name that is named, far above the stars and the sun and the moon. But we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. This is your dream. See Jesus. This is your confidence, to see Jesus. For we, like Joseph, we live in an unfinished story that draws us into God's final act, as we also said this morning. And while we wait for our redemption, we too are suffering in various ways. The Bible, and think of the book of Revelation that we studied over the course of 2 years. The book of Revelation and the whole Bible predicts a suffering church in the last days, dying as creation itself unravels. But through suffering, God will make his church beautiful and manifest his glory. In the last days, his bride will be made beautiful and pure, waiting for the return of her Lord to reign with him. And so Joseph's dream of royalty and a future greatness, this is your dream, to reign with Christ forever and ever. So come quickly, Lord Jesus, for the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever. Amen.